On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with investigative journalist Will Storr about his books, Will Storr versus the Supernatural and The Unpersuadables, Adventures with the Enemies of Science.
All those prejudices and all those biases which kind of lead everybody, no matter who they are, me and you included, sometimes down wrong alleys, and wrong alleys that can seem absolutely real, that can seem, we are convinced we are right. We are convinced the other person is lying or biased or whatever. And, you know, we're wrong. And we're all guilty of that at some point in our lives.
So how do we sort it out? I mean, what did you come away with at the end of the day as some of the big takeaways in terms of how we get at the truth?
Well, I mean, boring as it sounds, you know, this, I mean, the scientific method is that thing that the kind of humanity has come across, is that method that humanity has come across to, and it, you know, it's not a clean, perfect engine. It moves forward in this kind of bad-tempered mode of crotchety consensus, and sometimes it has to have reversals, and you know, it's a difficult thing, but it works. You know, in that great macro view, it works. It works. In terms of breaking down, you know, in breaking down those prejudices, breaking down those biases, breaking down those people who have those wrong alleys. I mean, so the scientific method works.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Skaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have a really great interview with investigative journalist and author Will Storr. If you haven't heard of Will and his books before, I think you'll really enjoy his approach to these topics, these forbidden topics that we delve into here on Skeptico. But before we get to that interview, I want to make just a couple of really quick announcements. A couple of listeners have pointed me to this really, really interesting free online parapsychology course that you can check out. We'll have a link to in the show notes. Some really, really top-notch people have been involved in putting together this very impressive course, and you can check it out for free. We'll have a link to that. And just one more thing, one of our former guests, Artie Sixkiller Clark, who wrote a really amazing book about alien encounters with American Indians, has written a new book, Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. And that is out now, or will be out next week. And she dropped me a note and asked me if I'd mention that, and I certainly will. I enjoyed when she came on the show, and she certainly has a interesting perspective and tell some great accounts on that. So check that out if you're interested as well. But now let's get on to today's interview, my dialogue with Will Storr. Today we welcome journalist and author Will Storr to Skeptico. With books like Will Storr versus the Supernatural, in which Will personally investigated all manners of paranormal phenomena that we're going to want to talk to him about, and The Unpersuadables, Adventures with the Enemies of Science, where Will sat down with New Earth creationists and climate change deniers in an effort to understand why we all seem to believe the things that we believe. Well, with these books, Will is a perfect guest for Skeptico, I think. He's attempted to, in my view, kind of walk this razor's edge of balancing rationality with that which doesn't fit so easily with our understanding of reality. Will, it's really a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining me.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for asking me, Alex.
Well, you know, I've been looking forward to this. And, you know, where I thought we might start, Will, naturally, is tell people a little bit about yourself and a little bit more about these books that I just mentioned.
Yeah, so I've been a journalist for 14 years now, and the first book you mentioned I wrote when I was in my 20s is getting on for 10 years old now, which is making me feel very old. And that was, as you say, Will Storr versus the Supernatural, and that followed kind of an experience I had. It's one of the first stories I ever did, actually, as a journalist, and I kind of found this website for this guy called Lou Gentili, who called himself a demonologist. And, you know, he was based in Philadelphia, and he would go around people who had said they lived in haunted houses and sort of gathering evidence, things like EVP, ghost lights, these kinds of things. And I kind of pitched this story thinking it was just going to be hilarious. And this guy was going to be, you know, a bit of an object of kind of ridicule, if I'm honest. But of course, I went along and spent 3 days absolutely scared, witless. I mean, everything he said was going to happen actually happened. And I remember sort of going back to my hotel at sort of 4 a.m. after the first night with him and literally not wanting to turn the light off because I was so terrified. So that obviously, I mean, that was it really shit me up. I mean, I've always been an atheist. I was brought up in a very strict Catholic household. And even I remember, you know, sort of being at Catholic school when I was sort of 7 or 8 and being told the story of Jesus and thinking this is obviously nonsense. Thinking, you know, like Mary's pregnant, right? But she's saying that she didn't sleep with anyone, right? Yeah, right. You know, that was always, I just thought, is it instinctively, that's been my thing. And this really shook me up, you know, it really shook me up. And so Will Store versus the Supernatural, you know, is the story. I spent a year basically hanging out with people who believe in ghosts.
But that's a style that you follow. I mean, I think it's really cool. I mean, you're like an embedded journalist. You know, we always hear that term in the war correspondent. I mean, and there's a long tradition of that. But I really like the way that you do that and the way you bring yourself both into the story, but manage to kind of pull yourself back out a little bit too. And that's been your style all along, right? Even with your subsequent books. I know it is with the Unpersuadables as well, or the Heretics as it's known in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you know, there are a few journalists in Britain anyway who do this kind of thing, and they're very good at it and have their own, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, I don't want to disparage them even slightly because they're, you know, they're better than me in a lot of ways. But one of the things that I kind of feel about people who do this kind of stuff is that I sometimes worry about their motives. You know, like I was genuinely interested in people who believe in ghosts. I was genuinely unsure whether ghosts existed, if the phenomena did exist, if it was real, what was it? It was a sincere attempt at finding the truth. It started off as a cynical exercise in making fun of somebody. I mean, you know, that's the sad truth, but it ended up being a much more serious kind of journey, although kind of, you know, lighthearted in places, and even more so with the Unpersuadables. I mean, that kind of deepens the search. I mean, I'm 10 years older, so I'm taking these things a bit more seriously. And that's also about people who believe things that go kind of against the orthodoxy in some way. And as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, whether that be sort of new earth creationists or people who believe that schizophrenia is a made up, you know, is not a real disease, and that people who hear voices are not actually sick. They just have a different way of experiencing the world. You know, all kinds of groups that go against the orthodoxy in some way, you know. And it was an investigation of, you know, and again, it goes back to my childhood. My dad, I didn't go to university. I'm really badly educated, but my dad went to Oxford, you know, and as growing up, I used to kind of see him as this kind of amazing, towering figure of intellect. And yet he believed in the Christmas story, right, and, you know, Jesus. And he actually believes, he believes the devil is a real thing kind of prancing about the world, making people do evil things. I mean, it's crazy in my head. And that was always just a weird thing. I think, you know, my problem with a lot of the skeptical movement, which I kind of came across for the first time when I was researching my ghost book, is that they have this kind of idea that people who believe in things that go against the orthodoxy are somehow stupid. And you know, I've met an awful lot of these people, probably a lot more than most of the people who hang out in these skeptical circles, and they're not stupid. Like, they're not stupid. And to call them stupid is an intellectual dead end for me. It's boring, you know. Yeah, okay, so they might be wrong about some things, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean they're stupid. And the interesting thing
is, I'm not so sure on that. No, I mean, I hear where you're coming from. And I think that feeling of, or that willingness to be open and respectful is important. And to hear people's stories, that's something else I've heard you emphasize, is that we have to kind of separate out people's own stories, because we all have our stories that keep us going, that keep us getting up in the morning and keep us from staying up all night. You have to respect that. But at the same time, I also appreciate and relate to your sensibility of, we do have to try and get to something close to the truth. I mean, we do have to kind of sort this out in a way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that, you know, people believe what they believe, not because they're stupid, but because that's that, you know, because the human brain is a kind of fallible and irrational thing that kind of operates in this kind of story mode. You know, we live our lives as if we're the hero in a kind of David and Goliath kind of narrative, generally speaking. And, you know, I think that's the kind of the theme of that book. And, you know, and absolutely we have the scientific method. We know we have the scientific method, which breaks down all those prejudices and all those biases, which kind of lead everybody, no matter who they are, me and you included, sometimes down wrong alleys and wrong alleys that can seem absolutely real, that can seem, we are convinced we are right. We are convinced the other person is lying or biased or whatever. And, you know, we're wrong. And we're all guilty of that at some point in our lives.
So how do we sort it out? I mean, what did you come away with at the end of the day as some of the big takeaways in terms of how we get at the truth?
Well, I mean, boring as it sounds, you know, this, I mean, the scientific method is that thing that the kind of humanity has come across, is that method that humanity has come across to, and it, you know, it's not a clean, perfect engine. It moves forward in this kind of bad tempered mode of crotchety consensus. And sometimes it has to have reversals, and, you know, it's a difficult thing, but it works, you know, in that great macro view, it works. It works in terms of breaking down, you know, in breaking down those prejudices, breaking down those biases, breaking down those people who have those wrong alleys. I mean, so the scientific method works. The other thing that I really took away is much sort of simpler to understand is that, you know, I've become extraordinarily concerned about people who become over emotional about subjects. And one of the kind of interviews I did for the book, which really affected me and kind of changed the way I saw all this, was this guy called Professor Jonathan Haidt, who I don't know if he's been on your show or not.
He's not, no.
He's a psychologist, and he's written a couple of books, The Happiness Hypothesis and The Righteous Mind. And he's interested in people's moral views. He's interested in how we come upon those moral views. He's interested in political views, how we become left-wing or right-wing. And he said to me, you know, if you want to find irrationality, find things that people would have made sacred.
Right.
And the examples that he used were, so on the left, he said, you know, he said, I'm a scientist. I believe in man-made climate change. I believe what the, you know, that it's a real thing and all that stuff. So get that out of the way. But I do not trust the left to tell me the truth about climate change because they've made it sacred. And on the right, you know, the same with the right wing and the power of the free market. You know, people on the right, they, you know, they proselytize the free market, the invisible hand that can only do good things. You know, he doesn't trust the right to tell him the truth about the free market because they've made it sacred. And, you know, and when you make something sacred, you get really emotional about it. So that's kind of a red flag to me. And again, you see that a lot. You know, I think, you know, Richard Dawkins always comes up in these conversations. And I think he's really interesting because, you know, I think he's right about most of what he says. It's very hard to poke holes in his arguments in terms of the science. But I think what people have is an instinctive distrust of people like Dawkins and Sam Harris because they're so emotional, they're so angry, and they will brook no criticism of their arguments whatsoever. And I mean, and that's, you know, that's instinctive in people, but that's very wise. And I think it's very true that, you know, no matter who you are, if you're overly emotional about the thing that you're thinking about, that's the point where, unfortunately, I believe you cannot trust yourself to think about it clearly. The conclusions and the opinions that your brain is throwing up for you are suspect, and you should be kind of on high alert for, you know, your own rationality. If you find yourself, you know, with your heartbeat racing and your adrenaline pumping and everything becomes really personal, that's when you're in that kind of danger zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that quote that you give about when we make something sacred, that's kind of the red flag that we've maybe crossed the line of rationality. But I do have to wonder, you know, in your books, which both those two are the ones that I delved into, both the Unpersuadables, that's what it's called here in the United States. In the UK, it's the title is The Heretics. And this older one that I found really some great stories, and they're very entertaining books too. I mean, they're real page turners and you have a great style, but the other one was Will Storr versus The Supernatural. But both the books I felt came tantalizingly close to kind of saying something or really uncovering something big. And then they kind of backed off and just kind of left it in that zone of kind of figure it out for yourself, which on one hand is okay. But on the other hand, you know, you just touched on some great topics that I'd love to delve into. You know, science, you say ultimately it's about the scientific method. I think the scientific method is awesome. I think the same way that you do, as a way of pulling back from the biases and prejudices we all have and getting beyond that, fantastic. But, you know, the story that you just told, Will, you go and encounter this demonologist and at the very least come away with an unexplainable experience. Well, where's the man on the moon effort by science to follow up on your experience? Or we could even start out with why were you conditioned to believe that this was going to be totally a farce when, you know, some of the best science 100 years ago, all the best scientists had studied this extensively in the UK. That's where they really started. And they came to the conclusion that there's something here. We don't know what it is, but there's something there. And you experienced the same thing. But there's no, like I said, there's no man on the moon effort to say, okay, well, this totally contradicts our paradigm, has the potential to totally change our worldview. Let's investigate it.
Obviously I can't answer that question. I'm not a scientist and I don't in any respect kind of speak for the scientific community. I'm preaching to somebody who knows far more about these subjects than I do. You know, we live in a materialistic kind of world, and we live in a world in which the vast majority of the scientific community, is thinking from that paradigm. And I mean, and you know as well as I do, when it comes to things like scientific, there is ideology in science. Absolutely, there's ideology in science. One of the things that people do get really emotional about is this materialistic mindset. And in The Unpersuadables, I spent some time talking about Rupert Sheldrake. I mean, I think he's been on your show a couple of times, right? Rupert Sheldrake.
Sure.
And the experiences he's had. And quite apart from who's right and who's wrong and the science behind that, you've only got to look at the way he's been treated and the things that he's experienced to see that the people who rubbish him and the people who seek to kind of have his voice silenced, and that's no exaggeration. You know, people are, you know, if he's, as you know, he, you know, when he's booked to appear at live events, there, you know, people agitate and protest until he's taken off the bill. I mean it's quite extraordinary. He's just a man with some ideas. You know, they've made it sacred, they've made materialism sacred, and that's why I don't trust them to tell me the truth about materialism. But you know, science is also about funding, so you know, scientists need if you do find scientists who are sympathetic to these ideas, then you know that there's a chance they're unlikely to want to study this stuff because they're afraid of being ridiculed, they're afraid of their reputations being destroyed. Right. But then there's also in funding. People prioritize. I completely agree. You know, these major questions about reality. You know, and I think a lot of those are being looked at, but they're being looked at by cosmologists rather than parapsychologists. I mean, these are the people who really are being paid some money and who are celebrated for asking these big questions and coming up with some very weird ideas like the multiverse and things like this. So that work's being done. But you know, I think when people are looking to fund,
well, you know, here, let me redirect it a little bit, Will, because you know, take your book, The Heretics. And one of the stories in there, you talk to this fairly interesting guy. He's not that interesting, but the story is interesting. He's a New Earth creationist, you know, and you really you really try and connect with this guy. I mean, that's one of the great things about your story with him is you're not quick to ridicule and judge him. You're kind of like, come on, man, you know, you don't really believe this stuff, do you? And we all come away from that story reading it and going, wow, you know, this guy is locked into this just absurd kind of worldview. But when I step back and like I tell you this, I relate the story of the demonologist, I say, aren't we all in these kind of bracketed absurdities that we kind of live in and we feel comfortable in? And that's what I guess I was kind of relating to your story with the demonologist. I mean, you mentioned Dawkins.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a great example. I mean, let's go back to him, the favorite guy for everyone to either laud or pick on, depending on what side you're on. Here's a guy who's told us that we are biological robots living in a meaningless universe. This is an absurdity. To you, it's an absurdity. To me, it's an absurdity. To everyone, it's an, no one lives their life like that. No one really believes it. But because it comes from this kind of sanctioned position, we kind of go, well, you know, let them go. Don't make too big of a deal about it. And just like when we pass the Catholic Church, we go, well, you know, hey, you know, some people believe, some people don't. It's this bracketed bit of absurdity. So I think when we draw out somebody who's really over the edge, this New Earth creationist, we go, now that's absurd. But all these other absurdities that I just kind of live with.
Well, I mean, for me, my personal view is I'm not sure that Dawkins is being that absurd when he says that. I mean, I don't know the secrets of reality and the meaning of life and the secrets of the universe. Richard Dawkins says he does. I mean, he may well be right. I mean, you know, that, I mean, there's lots of evidence to show that, you know, that points to this idea that life may well be completely meaningless. I mean, you know, meaning is, you know, in lots of ways, it's an illusion, and that's part of where we go wrong. I mean, going back to the creationist, I mean,
but Will, let me just start. I won't go into, yeah, you know, I just wrote a book, Why Science Is Wrong, about almost
okay.
Everything.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So
right,
but the point, one of the points of that book is that there's tons of evidence that we live with every day, including the placebo, yeah, effect and hypnosis and near-death experience and all these other things that tell us that experimentally, the evidence is in, overwhelmingly, that's just doesn't hold up. I mean, whether you have a strong position about it, whether you're, right, you make it sacred or not, the evidence just doesn't point that direction. But moreover, we don't live our lives like that. No one believes they're a biological robot living in a meaningless world. No one, if in time, has ever believed that. It's a bracketed absurdity, right? So we don't really touch it. We don't really go there. Your experience, I mean, the experience you had with some kind of anomalous communication, some kind of afterlife communication, again, the amount of experience across culture, across time, in the reality of that phenomena is overwhelming. Most people accept that there's somehow, you know, in the back of their mind, they think, well, there's probably something to that. I've heard that too much. But yet we kind of bracket it either one way or another, and that's how we navigate. So back to your excellent books. I mean, how do we sort through our own stuff, our own assumed absurdities that then make us look out at the world and say, "Wow, you know, that's really how can they believe that? Whatever they believe."
But I think the answer is in humility. I think, you know, it is as much as you, you know, believe everything that you believe is true, is just to have that basic fundamental understanding that everybody else believes what they believe just as much as you, and they believe the evidence is in just as much as you, and they see their reality just as clearly and as truly as you see yours. And to have that humility to go, okay, so, you know, so here's me sincerely believing all this stuff, and here's that person over there equally sincerely believing all their stuff. And I don't know, I think when you're at that point of kind of proselytizing and, you know, being evangelical about your beliefs, I mean, for me, that's the point where you just need to have a bit of humility and to understand that the brain is an organ of delusion. You know, it is going to tell you you're right. You know, everybody suffers from confirmation bias. Everybody's going to look at good evidence that contradicts their beliefs and find some way, some wiggle room, which enables them to dismiss it. And that isn't a sign of not being intelligent. You know, there was a study I read about, I didn't put it in the book, but there was a study I read about that showed that the more intelligent you are, the harder it is to challenge your own beliefs, because the better you are at finding reasons to dismiss the arguments of your opponents. So intelligence becomes a kind of trap. You know, it can actually lead you further into this irrationality. So it's just, I suppose, to me, the starting point now is this basic fundamental humility. I mean, you know, even in my writing now, it's terrible for my career, because the writers who are famous are the ones who are on the, you know, who are standing up there,
who are certain,
thumping their tubs, shouting, you know, insulting people, causing a lot of fuss. And I just can't do that, because what if I'm wrong? You know, but I have to give both sides a fair crack of the whip, because what if I'm wrong? And I think, you know, and I think, might not do my book sales any good, but I think that's the correct, you know, once you know all this stuff about how the brain works, once you know all this stuff about how possible it is to be completely wrong and it can utterly convince you're right with all the best evidence on your side, you can't ever go back to that place of thinking, you know, that kind of goody baddie paradigm that so many people, in, you know, including a lot of the atheists, skeptics, kind of exist in. You know, we've not mentioned James Randi yet. I mean, James Randi is, you know, the original Richard Dawkins in a way. I mean, obviously without the academic background, but the original Mr. Angry. And, you know, look, I mean, when you poke the kind of James Randi cult, it all falls to bits fairly quickly.
Well, you know, you touched on something in your book and in interviews I've seen with you that I think is really a deep insight. And you encapsulated in this quote, "What if the truth alters me, fractures something essential in me?" And do you want to speak to that? Because I think that's the underlying fear here, you know, that I have things kind of under control. In a crazy, insane world, I have things kind of under control. Do I really want to explore a truth? What if that truth somehow really fractures me in some way?
I mean, as you say, it kind of goes to the heart of what I kind of found when I was working on The Unpersuadables. I mean, you can start at the very beginning with that creationist. And, you know, one of the most notable things about the creationist was he was just a massive homophobe. You know, he really did not like gay people. I mean, you know, they were going to hell, they were living in disobedience to God, and they should, you know, they were like really, you know, very aggressive homophobia. And you know, what I found doing the book is that, you know, what happens is that we start with the belief, we start with what we believe, and then we go out into the world looking for reasons to justify that belief. You know, they call it the make sense stopping rule. Somebody like John Mackay, a creationist who has that kind of brain, will look at gay people, will think about two men kissing or whatever, and they may feel something like disgust. And, you know, I call it in the book, you know, the hero maker, the brain being the hero maker. It makes us the hero of our stories. So what do some people say about people who look at homosexuality and think about homosexuality and feel disgust? Well, they say they're horrible. They're bigots. They're homophobes. They're nasty people. They're, you know, on the same page as racists. But someone like John Mackay can't believe that, because it would fracture his psyche. It would destroy him to believe that. Because he would become the bad guy. He'd become the villain in his own brain. So he goes out into the world. He looks for a set of beliefs that justify those emotional, instinctive, instant experiences he has. And he finds that in Old Testament Christianity. He finds that. So when he reads passages in the Bible, in the Old Testament, which says, you know, whatever it's to do with a man lies with the man, the punishment is death, or whatever it says, he goes, this is true. He feels instinctively, this is the truth. I have found the truth. And we all do that. You know, we all start off with the instinctive beliefs. Our unconscious does the work for us. You know, if somebody gives us an opinion or a viewpoint, we have an instant emotional response to that viewpoint. All emotions boil down to two, approach or withdrawal. All emotions are variants on approach or withdrawal. And if we feel approach to that opinion, we will like that person. We'll think this person is not biased. They're not prejudiced. They're intelligent, wise people. And if it's a withdrawal emotion, we're going to think they're idiots. They're biased. They're prejudiced. They're or racist or homophobic. We're all stuck in this kind of paradigm, and you know, all of us. And it's for somebody like Richard Dawkins to even consider a non-materialist viewpoint, to even consider an idea that, you know, a non-local theory of consciousness. I mean, you know, I can't get inside his head, but I imagine the very idea would kind of make get his adrenaline rising and his blood pumping and the veins in his head throbbing. It's that instinctive, again, it goes back to the emotion. It's that instinctive emotional response. And when the emotional response is strong, you know, something's going wrong with the way we're thinking.
But then what hope is there? I mean, that's, if you really take the logical extension of that, I mean, it's pretty grim. I mean, because you take the science or the best knowledge that we have according to the scientific method, and then we move it into the public arena, into the decisions that really make and affect our lives. And if it's all filtered and completely overwhelmed by these irrational prejudices, what hope is there really to come through this?
Well, one of the chapters that I ended up liking the most in The Unpersuadables is the one that talks about schizophrenia. And I like this one because it wasn't scientist versus non-scientist. It was scientist versus scientist. So, you know, there were two guys. One who's written some brilliant books on mental illness. He's a professor. Another one, a doctor, a former vice president of the Royal Institute of Psychiatry. You know, both people immersed in the literature, immersed in the journals, you know, you can't tell them anything about their subject area. And yet at complete opposites of the scale, one person says that schizophrenia is a real biological disease, and you can tell it's a real disease because you look in the brain of schizophrenics and you can see the damage that schizophrenia has caused their brain. So their brains have shrunk in size, and there are certain ventricles that show damage. Now, what the other scientist says is that voice hearing, schizophrenia doesn't exist, but people who hear voices, it's because of some sort of trauma like sexual abuse. And the reason you can see in the brain these changes is because they have to take these awful antipsychotic medication, which, you know, mucks your brain up. What I liked about that chapter was I went back and forth between them a few times, and they ended up just, it was like playground insults, calling each other stupid, he's an idiot, oh, I despair, and all this stuff. They ended up behaving just like you and me would down the pub, having, disagreeing about something that we cared passionately about. So there you have, you know, if you drill down into the scientific method, into this kind of rarefied world of science, down to the level of the individual scientists, they're just like you and me. They're just as prejudiced, just as biased, just as unable to see the arguments of the other person. But the science does work on the macro view. Like, at some point, this row will be settled. I mean, the side that says that schizophrenia isn't real, they were called, it all started in Europe, and there was a movement called the Hearing Voices Network, which was, there was some quote from the year 2000 saying they were one of the most dangerous movements in psychiatry, because they're encouraging people with schizophrenia to come off their medications. So that we're a feared organization. And 10 years later, some of the methods they found to help people who hear voices have been absorbed into the mainstream. It's standard practice now. Before, you used to be told to ignore your voices. If you heard voices, ignore them. It's like, you know, if you engage with them, it'll just make it worse. But what the Hearing Voices Network people started experimenting with was actually talking to your voices, negotiating with them. If you're out on the street, and you feel like you can't ignore them, pull out your cell phone and pretend you're having a conversation. If you're having a chat on the phone with somebody and the voices are intrusive, just say to your voice, listen, I can't talk to you now, but I'll speak to you later on. These are dangerous ideas, or they were 14 years ago, and now they've gone mainstream. So you see how, it works slowly, and on the individual level, people disagree and there are arguments and there's controversy. But the good thing is, the truth leaks out, the right way leaks out, and that's how we move forward.
Oh, that's a huge leap of faith there, Will. That's a huge leap of faith. It just is. I mean, you take that same scenario, and I love that chapter and that example, because I think it illustrates so many points. But, you know, there's a number of people that I've interviewed, really some of the top consciousness researchers in the world. And there's a completely different theory about consciousness, since we really don't know how consciousness is created, whether it's created in the brain or whether it's just the brain is like a receiver transceiver that's somehow tuning into consciousness. But the best evidence we have is some of the evidence you stumbled across in your demonology experiment. But when you take that into the lab or clinically, you look at near-death experience, or you look at terminal lucidity. All these things have been done in hospitals, and they say, hey, well, clearly our relationship between brain and consciousness isn't what we think it is. It isn't this one-to-one thing. Or you just look at, there's a bunch of good research done in the UK on psychedelics, so psilocybin, you know, and we give somebody a bunch of heroic dose of psilocybin, to use a Terrence McKenna term, and their brain is supposed to be firing off like crazy because they're having this incredibly hyperlucid experience. And we find the opposite. We find that the brain is shutting down in different parts as if it's tuning into some consciousness from the outside. Wow. I don't need to sell you that whole thing. I just need to come back.
I've never heard that. That's interesting.
But I just need to come back and point out, what would that paradigm shift mean to that whole debate that you were just kind of reporting on? It would just throw it in the dustbin of history and the dustbin of science and say, well, those guys thought that consciousness was a product of the brain. So they were arguing two different things about the brain, but it isn't about the brain. It's about this other aspect of, you know, you mentioned Sheldrick. It's something akin to some field out there, field of energy, whatever the answer would be. What's the old analogy of, you know, you're climbing the ladder of knowledge, but you're leaned up against the wrong wall, so it's never going to work. I mean, I think we have to consider that we're not going to get there from here with the methods and the tools that we have in place. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, my thoughts on that are not right now. I mean, with the whole, you know, at the end of the Rupert Sheldrake kind of experience I had, you know, consciousness, that kind of level of neuroscience is extremely complex. And when you drill down into the arguments between the people who believe that in the non-local ideas and who believe in the materialistic ideas, it very quickly becomes far too complex for the layman to understand. And you end up, my experience of, like, especially looking through the skeptic kind of versus believer forums, is that you get the sense that people are arguing about very advanced statistical methods that actually they have no idea about what they're doing is picking sides and picking an expert. You know what we do? We pick an expert, don't we? We pick the professor that argues for our case.
So, but my other thought about that goes back to, there was a chapter that I actually did on history, and it was about Holocaust deniers. And there was a quote from Professor Deborah Lipstadt, who is somebody who has kind of agitated against and written a lot about Holocaust denial before. And she was writing about this guy, David Irving, this British historian who has kind of defended Hitler. And he argues that Hitler was Hitler didn't order the Holocaust. Hitler knew nothing about the Holocaust.
Right.
And his the main sort of peg of his the evidence for this, he says, is that there isn't a document. There isn't that kind of magic bullet document where he signs saying, yes, I agree with the Holocaust. I order the Holocaust. And what Deborah Lipstadt said was that as historians, we don't look for the magic bullet. We look for a convergence or a nexus of evidence. And I love that quote because it speaks to me for the brain kind of wars debate as well. I think there can be a million Rupert Sheldrakes, but things are so emotional in that kind of sphere of science that they're never going to get anywhere. They're always going to be ignored, no matter how sound their evidence seems. I think if we do find the answer to consciousness is non-material, is non-local, that evidence is going to have to come from a different part of science, from a different, you know, there's going to have to be a big breakthrough, a discovery in some other area for this to be taken seriously. That's my own personal feelings. You know, maybe I'm naive, but I do think if it's true that consciousness is non-local, we'll get there. May not be in my lifetime or your lifetime, Alex, unfortunately, but we'll get there. It's kind of inevitable. But, you know, at the moment, it's just too emotional. It's, you know, and the people who are arguing for it, there's not enough people. And they're easily disparaged by this kind of very radical, politicized community of skeptics we have at the moment.
Will, how has your work changed you? I mean, changed you kind of in some of these fundamental beliefs. Maybe fundamental is too strong of a word, but I mean, I can think, you know, I've done 250 shows and now wrote this little book, but I can think of a dozen ways that I just was like, wow, you know, I used to think that. Now I think this. What has been the process like for you? Because you've been right in there on the front line with this stuff, and I know you take it in personally. What are some ways that you've changed?
When I was in my teenage years, I was a classic angry skeptic kind of guy. You know, I was angry at my parents for being Catholic. I was angry at Christians in general for being so stupid and for causing all the wars. And it's actually been a journey of, again, humility. What happens when you go and meet these people with an open mind is before you've met them, you think they're idiots or they're hateful or they're, you know, whatever. You believe what 99% of people believe about these people. And then you meet them. And if you meet them and sincerely and showing a genuine interest in their story and trying to find out why they believe what they believe, even if you don't end up agreeing with them, you can understand why, how they've ended up where they are. You can understand, the story of their lives, the story of how they've got there. And you leave much more empathetic. And that's actually a kind of a nicer place because you leave less angry. And I suppose the main thing is it's made me kind of less angry at other people. It wasn't until I got to the right to the end of the Unpersonables it occurred to me how weird it is that when somebody disagrees with you, when somebody has an opinion that isn't the same as yours, you react with anger. You react like you can't rest until you've kind of bashed them down. you've changed the shape of their brain so it mimics yours. I mean, what is that? It's weird, but we're all like it. You know, we all have those buttons pushed, and it's this. You know, it's a very human insecurity that we have to have everybody surrounding us agreeing with us at all times. Otherwise, we feel very unnerved, very anxious. And I'm less like that now. I mean, I'm not cured. I'll never be cured. You know, I'm still human. But, I, you know, I, I'm less liable to respond with anger if somebody doesn't agree with me. You know, I get it now, and I get it because I'm just thinking I'm probably just as, you know, deluded as you are.
You know, it's funny. I think of the story of the famous flim-flam artist, the guy who was the story behind the Catch Me If You Can movie, who went around and impersonated people and passed all these bad checks. And they had him on the big talk show here in the United States, Johnny Carson's late night show. And he said, you know, how do you do it? How do you make these people believe you? And he said, you know, the most powerful thing that I've found is to disagree with someone strongly and get into this big argument and then sit back thoughtfully and go, you know, after I think about it, I think you're right. You've changed my mind. And he said, that's the most powerful thing for us to feel like we've changed somebody's mind. We've won them over. And I just have to laugh because, I mean, I can relate to what you're talking about. I can relate to the anger and the need and the want to kind of show somebody the truth. And gosh darn it, you got to believe it. I wonder what that is about us that has this need to kind of show people the light. I mean, but so many of us have it.
Because it's actually something very, if you really think about it, me, there's something very aggressive about it. It's almost like an act of violence. You know, someone comes to you with a different worldview, and you want to reach into their kind of brain and, you know, rearrange their walls. You know, it's a really odd thing. And, you know, you notice that, you know, there are certain personality types who, you know, I spent time with James Randi. I spent time with David Irving, the historian who, you know, I mean, obviously you wasn't aware of James Randi's $1 million challenge. What made me chuckle was that David Irving once had, I think it was a 500-pound challenge to anybody that could prove that Hitler ordered the Holocaust.
Right.
Or is it my 5,000-pound challenge? I mean, you know, that John Mackay, the creationist, these angry men who had gathered bands of hugely loyal people around them and just had that charisma. There was something about the personalities of these people that they were obsessed with this mission. They were completely lost in this idea that they were right and everybody else was wrong. They had no ability to accept any kind of criticism or accept for a moment that they're wrong. And you know, we're all like this to a certain extent, but there is a certain personality type which is really like this. I like this a lot. And these people are the people that become famous. These people that kind of have this kind of cult of personality gather around them.
Yeah. Well, it's just an excellent body of work. And there's other books by Will that you're certainly going to want to check out. They're all at Will Storr. That's WILLSTORR.com or .co.uk. But Will, it's been great having you on. Thanks so much and best of luck with all your work. Is there anything else? I'm sorry. Is there anything else we should talk about or stuff that's coming up for you? Do you have anything new that's coming out?
I'm about to start work on the next book, but it's going to be a few years till that comes out. But that's about the self. So I'm going further into this kind of idea of the self as kind of hero of our story. So I've no idea where that journey is going to take me yet. So I'm kind of nervous and excited about that at the moment.
Is that how you get when you start these projects? Kind of nervous because you don't know where it is going to take you and how it is going to change you.
Yeah. And also just the amount of, I mean, you've written a book, the sheer amount of work you can see in front of you and how awfully it might, how badly it might go wrong if you don't work really hard. So that, I think it's that too.
Well, best of luck with all that. And thanks again for joining me.
Nice. Pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks again to Will Storr for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I guess I'd have to tee up from this interview, and that has to do with how do we check ourselves, I guess you'd say. You know, Will makes a point in his book about how emotion can cause folks to run wild with ideas that when we step back and look at them as a culture, as a group, say, wow, how do people get in those kind of positions? How do you know when you're going over the top on a subject? Or how do you see that happening with other people? When we see people cross over what we perceive as the crazy line, I think for most of us, it's a little baffling, like, wow, how did they get there? So let's try and unravel that. What is your process for checking yourself? And what do you recommend for other people to keep from going too far with these topics? Of course, the place to voice your opinion, to share your thoughts on that is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can join our forum and join the discussion there. Leave a comment directly on the website or connect with me personally through Facebook or email. I do want to thank all of you who, in response to the last episode of Skeptico, went out and bought my book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. It was really kind of exciting to see that Amazon ranking spike up from the millions into the, I don't know, it got to like 30,000 or something for a brief period, which was kind of neat, kind of fun to see. So thank you for that. Anyone who is interested in the book, it is now available on Kindle as well. You can find it on Amazon, and several people asked for that, and I think that's kind of essential, the Kindle version of it. So that's out there. So that's going to do it for this episode. I have a number of great shows coming up. We'll get to them just as fast as we can. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.